This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We usually tape in the offices of Raider, but today we're taping at my home. But I do want to thank Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible. Lafayette General has been a leader in telemedicine. With the Health Anywhere app, your family can access quality urgent care at any time without an appointment, all from the comfort of your home. It's the waiting room redefined. Download the app today at lghealthanywhere.com. Judge Jules Edwards is our guest today. A graduate of Loyola and Loyola Law School, Jules Edwards has served as a judge for the 15th Judicial District Court since January 1, 1993. He has been a pioneer of drug courts and reentry courts. Currently a candidate to serve as judge on Lafayette's City Court, the election is scheduled for November 3, 2020. Judge Edwards has distinguished himself with lifelong service to our country, state, and community. He enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve in 1977 and served in the Louisiana National Guard until 2007, retiring as a colonel and recognized as the best staff judge advocate in the United States. A former chair of the Louisiana Judiciary Commission, he was inducted into the Louisiana Justice Hall of Fame in 2013. He served as past president of the Louisiana District Judges Association. Judge Edwards is currently a member of the Advisory Council on Heroin and Opioid Prevention and Education and a member of the Louisiana Drug Policy Board. He has worked with the Louisiana Sentencing Commission in formulating and implementing a uniform sentencing policy. Judge Jules Edwards, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to visit with you.
You know, I've known you as a fellow lawyer, and I've known you, I guess, socially, but I had no idea of your background. I didn't know how long you had served as a district court judge. I didn't know your involvement in preventing drug crimes and helping youth. And I didn't really know about your service in the military. So if we can start, may I call you Jules or
please,
Judge
please
Edwards?
Please do. Please
okay,
do.
Jules, can you start with what got you to Loyola, got you into law school, and led you to become a judge?
Well, the short answer is I could never really figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. But I've always been a very curious person, and so I just continued to study and learn and grow, and opportunities presented themselves, and I was able to exploit each one of those opportunities. That's the short answer.
The long answer, though, did you grow up in New Orleans?
Oh yes, I grew up in New Orleans, and
In New Orleans?
So I grew up in Uptown New Orleans, fairly close to Audubon Park. If you know New Orleans, like major features would be I lived on Camp Street between Jefferson and Napoleon. Now, at Napoleon in Camp is the grade school I attended, St. Stephen's. Mm-hmm. And fairly close to there, maybe within eight blocks, is De La Salle. That's the high school I attended. It's on St. Charles.
Right.
And Loyola is just a little further south, I think, on St. Charles. And I could ride my bicycle to Loyola. My mother was a high school physical education teacher, public school. My father owned a shoe repair and luggage business, and he had all sorts of creative signs to attract people to his business. And I remember one, it says, I will heal you and I'll save your soul.
Really? And what was that about?
Well, he repairs, heals.
Uh-huh. I'll heal you and repair your soul.
So S-O-L-E. Yes. Yes.
So were they encouraging you to get a higher education?
Well, the education was very important to my parents. And they also focused on the importance of becoming, of character formation. And they really wanted me to become a servant leader. That was very, we were Catholics, and, mm-hmm. and that's all a part of that formation. And it was just very important, very emphasized that I needed to develop a good character, and I needed to be a leader, and I needed to be of service. How right. that would spell itself out in the future was open. Those were the primary things they were focusing on.
So was Loyola your go-to college, you know, being in that
I think it's the only school, that's the only school I applied to.
That's me with yeah. LSU. Like, yeah. I knew that I could afford it because I lived by, you know, my school, and mm-hmm. I could just mm-hmm. go to school. And was it the same thing for you, or did you get a scholarship?
I had a little bit of scholarship.
It wasn't, I never wasn't did, that much. Just
yes,
so you know.
Yes. It was... I think it was that it was Catholic education. My parents mm-hmm. were very interested in being in having a Catholic education. So I attended Catholic schools from first grade through law school. I went to a private kindergarten at a different location that was called Bush Elementary. I think that may have been a public school.
You learned your ABCs and right, how to count right, to 100. Huh?
Right, right. But my parents were amazing people. And my mother's still living. My father's deceased.
Oh, is she still in New Orleans?
My mother still lives in New Orleans. She's she has leukemia. She has a number of health issues. And so I'm the oldest of five mm-hmm. siblings. And we all take turns. My mother is my sister, who lives in New Orleans, has kind of moved in with her, and all the rest of us, we take turns on weekends coming to
right.
Visit with mom and take care of her.
So you graduated from Loyola Law School in 1984.
Yes.
How did you end up in Lafayette?
I met a girl.
Well, always.
So, and I always have an opportunity to tell students, particularly mm-hmm. young men. High school, grade school, you know, there's lots of good things you can find in the library. You know, I met
and
my
some
wife.
Of them are friends.
Yes,
huh?
I met my wife in the library. My wife attended Loyola Law School, and she and I were in the same class, and so I met her fairly early in the first semester. And by the time we graduated, we had become a couple.
So she wanted to come.
It was sort of an odd thing. She, out of law school, she clerked with Jeanette Noel
yeah.
at the Third Circuit. Mm-hmm. And I started up a little firm in Lafayette. We worked for different people for about 3 years or so. And then we decided it was time for us to open up a shop together.
Right.
And we had to consider, well, will we open the law firm in New Orleans, or will we open the law firm in Lafayette?
Mm-hmm.
And as fortune had it, that was around the time of the oil bust.
Yeah.
And so real estate was very inexpensive here in Lafayette. And so my mother grew up in Kaplan. So
okay.
So I've been visiting this area all my life.
Right.
And so to me, it really didn't make a difference, Lafayette, Kaplan. My wife kind of wanted to be close to home, and so it was Lafayette.
Right. And that was an opportunity.
Yes.
And before we move on, would you get in the names of your three children and your wife,
yes.
please?
My wife is Orita Edwards, and she was a Broussard. And as it happens, my mother is Lona Edwards, and she was a Broussard. Right? They're not related, but, you know, this is this area, right?
Right.
And so I married Orita, and we have three adult children.
All J's.
Yes. My oldest son is Jules the fourth, and then my daughter is Julissa, and then my youngest son is Julian. And so I...
When you're mad, do you just yell out?
Well, I yell out every one of the names, and somebody, they all come running.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to tell people that my wife was very wise, very wise. I married above my pay grade.
Of course.
And she...
You have to say that.
Yes. She's very wise, very prudent. And she named all of our children with a name that was very right. close to mine. So whenever I would speak their names, I would remember that I have a lot of responsibility.
And they came from you.
Yes.
So I know you graduated in 84, but I see that you joined the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve in 77. So I'm thinking your military experience was probably important in your the way you're handling things in life.
Yes. The military taught me a lot, and again, another opportunity for service, but also discipline and honor and integrity, all these character building opportunities. So I joined the Marine Corps Reserves the summer of my freshman year in college.
And why did you do that?
It's a short answer and a long answer. So there were a lot of my friends who joined the military, and it was a remarkable change.
Right.
And I was very impressed that it was a change for the better. And also, I was studying sociology and psychology, and I studied an intro to psych. It was B.F. Skinner, behavior modification. Yeah. And I was just amazed at the dramatic difference between these young men I knew before they went to boot camp and after they came from boot camp. It was a remarkable difference. These guys that were kind of slouching around and shucking and jiving.
Not getting up before 10.
Right.
Sounds like my kids.
When they came back, it was straight, ramrod. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, no, sir. And that was I had to see how that change occurred. So I wanted to serve, and I looked at all the branches, and I was most impressed with the Marine Corps, their mission, first to fight, and every Marine is a basic rifleman first, no matter what other kind of military occupational specialty you wind up in.
Right.
Everyone is an infantryman, a rifleman first. And again, to see how they change people's thoughts, how those people govern their emotions, and how they interact with other people and are so selfless and giving of themselves, that all of that, I wanted to see how it happens, and I wanted it to happen to me.
How did it happen? What did they do once you were in there? What happened?
Well, it's kind of, I'm not sure I have all the secrets, but
how did you feel, you know, being a part of that?
It was an amazing thing. It was like drinking water out of a fire hose.
Relief, like just to.
It's overwhelming. An overwhelming experience. So we had three drill instructors, and there was less than 30 guys in my platoon. And each of these three drill instructors always were impeccably dressed. You know, uniform,
shirts.
whether it was the combat uniform that was more casual or the dress uniform that was obviously more formal. But they would march us all over the base, and we would be exhausted, and they'd make us run through the dirt and roll around on the ground, and we'd be looking filthy. And these guys were always impeccable, and I could never figure it out. How are they able to do that? Slowly over time, I recognized that they would rotate on us. So it would be two of them that were always with us, and the third one would rotate out and change his uniform. These guys change their uniforms 6 or 7 times a day.
Right.
You know, so that they always had that look. And they had enough opportunity to learn each of us on an individual level.
With 30 in your group.
Yes, so they could learn our strengths, our weaknesses,
men.
And they slept with us, right? So they had an office that was adjacent to the open bay barracks, and so they would exchange notes about our performance all through the night, right, and preparing what they would do the next day. It was very thorough, very organized.
May I ask how you felt about yourself? Like, did you feel that you were fitting in? Like, was it a hard adjustment as a young man?
I didn't think I would be able to survive every day.
Right.
I thought that I would not be able to finish that day. And it was so overwhelming, the expectations, all the things, so relentless, that really the only way I was able to get through it is to say to myself, this moment will pass. Mm-hmm. Right?
Not today.
Not the day. I will not be able to get through the day. I will be able to get through this moment. And sure enough, that moment passed. And we would go, the only time that we would, and I was able to recognize, you know, they have to give us breaks. You know,
and did they?
They have. Well, they
like
have
for what? Water and
three
bathroom.
Meals.
Yeah, meals.
Yes. They have to.
So, were you in good shape as a young man? Were you an athlete? You're in good shape these days.
I was in the marching band. I was not.
You
an
were.
Athlete.
What did you play?
I played clarinet.
You did? Do you still play clarinet?
No.
What?
No.
I could have asked you to bring the clarinet screw it up.
No. Yes, I would mess it up bad.
But you were like
I was in the marching band. I did a lot of, you know, kind of running around in the neighborhood, and I had friends all around the neighborhood, and we would run to each other's houses, but we wouldn't run on the sidewalk. I'd jump this fence, jump that fence, to get
healthy.
Yeah, I was a wild, rambunctious kid. Yes.
So the military, I'm thinking, prepared you for your academic career. Did they help pay for your college?
No. It was the bank of mom and dad. Mm-hmm. It was Pell Grants. And a little scholarship from school.
Thank God for Pell Grants.
Oh yes.
Even today.
Indeed. What I received from the military was the salary and education. One good thing about the military, many people don't know this, but whatever your job is going to be, they send you to a school to learn that job, and then if they are going to reassign you to have a different job, then you go to that school. And the military is very good about training and preparing. So I had a lot of educational experiences mm-hmm. in the military. But I didn't
when you went to Loyola, that was on your own.
I did not receive the GI Bill. I did not get a VA loan for the house. None of that.
Right.
It's just the way things worked out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, Judge Edwards, I'd like to take a pause and talk about Discovers Lafayette's past, and then I'd like to jump into, you know, your law school, what you've done.
Yes.
And what you've built upon once you moved here to Lafayette. But let's pause for Discover Lafayette's Past, sponsored by our friends at Raleigh Marketing, a digital marketing agency that can assist you with marketing automation, content development, search engine optimization, and strategies on how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for your business. For more information, please visit RaleighMarketing.com. And now the moment. And you know, as you drove up, you're in the old Mouton Gardens here in Lafayette. So I want to share Lafayette's Azalea Trail, which originally began in 1935 when the Chamber of Commerce undertook a citywide beautification effort. By the late 1930s, the Garden Club of Lafayette was fully on board and walked door to door, encouraging local residents to plant azaleas. By 1940, it is estimated that over 40,000 visitors toured the scenic Azalea Trail in Lafayette. Tourists describe the azaleas as one of the greatest floral treats in the South, and a film entitled Les Jardins du Mouton Gardens was released by Commerce Pictures of New Orleans, depicting the many tourists who travel down Highway 90 to drive the Azalea Trail. And I've got to tell you, Judge Edwards, they taped our neighborhood, which had no homes here in the 1930s. By 1980, Southern Living named the Azalea Trail one of the top 10 tourist events in the South. But by the mid-1980s, urban sprawl and the demise of the J.C.'s who had overseen the trail in its last days, led to disinterest. The trail faded in memory. Fast forward to November 2014, when Scenic Lafayette was formed. In 2015, Scenic Lafayette adopted Azalea Trail Revitalization as its first year initiative. And in 2016, the City of Lafayette was awarded the Azalea City designation by Azalea Society of America, one of only 16 in the U.S. So the grand boulevards of St. Mary and Mall and all these other areas around the core of Lafayette showcase Lafayette's city flower, the General Lafayette Fuchsia Formosa, which was christened as such in honor of Marquita Lafayette. So I want to thank my friend and Azalea aficionado, Denise Lanklow, for being a former guest on Discover Lafayette and sharing this history with us. And I'm also partial to the story because not only do I live by the oil center in downtown, but a lot of people don't realize that Lafayette's city has really been maintained all of North Lafayette. And the oil center really has some historic azaleas. And I'm sure you see those as you drive to downtown when you go to the courthouse.
and that reminds me, I learned a lot by listening to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you, Judge.
And I'm reminded when I moved here in the 80s, there was a lot of promotion of the Azalea Trail.
And then it went away.
I remember hearing that on the radio. Yes, indeed.
Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
So we're here really to talk about positive things in Lafayette. And I want to kind of jump in. You had your private law firm.
Yes.
Maybe you want to talk first about your service as a judge advocate in the military. Like, you really have served well.
Well, it took me a while to get there. I as I mentioned, I enlisted in the Marine Corps in my summer of my
very young
freshman year in college, and I continued with that, and I had an opportunity to join ROTC, and I was trying to figure out what service would I go into. Would it be the Marine Corps or a different service? And it turns out that the Louisiana National Guard had something that they called the simultaneous membership program, which meant that I could be in the National Guard and also in ROTC at the same time. So I could continue with that track to become an officer, and I would get some experience in the Louisiana National Guard at the pseudo as a cadet. There's a rank of sergeant, okay? And so that was very appealing to me, and so that's what I did. I ended up joining the National Guard, and then I got my commission as a second lieutenant in the United States Army. And when you're in the Army, in the National Guard, you're in the state force, you serve the governor, and you're also in the federal force serving the president. So it's a dual force. So the vast majority of the time, you're in the state service, but should there be a national emergency, the president could activate the National Guard
and go overseas
to fight the war.
But the
National Guard was on call for state emergencies, so hurricanes, floods, that sort of thing. And so my initial position in the National Guard, I was in the artillery. So I was a forward observer and a leader of a forward observer team.
When was that? What years? Do you remember?
Oh my gosh!
That was early.
No, that was it was in the 80s.
So a few years after.
Yeah. So 70. I stayed in the Marines for maybe 3 or 4 years. Uh-huh. Right. And so,
and then in school,
and I was in school throughout this whole time, and I stayed in the artillery all the way through law school, right? And after law school, I was in the artillery for maybe 3 or 4 years until finally I got into the Judge Advocate General's Corps, and that's the Army lawyers.
Is that cool?
Oh, it's very exciting.
I mean, I can't even imagine doing that. You saw a lot.
Well,
people making hard decisions, and questioned about it.
The way we were organized, that we had lawyers dispersed throughout the various major commands. Mm-hmm. So the lawyers would be providing legal advice to the commander on the law of war and also handle military discipline. So if there'd be court martials, that sort of stuff. And so I continued in that capacity until General Whipple. I was at the brigade here in Lafayette, 256th Infantry Brigade, it was called at that time. And General Whipple pulled me aside and said, well, I need somebody to serve as an inspector general, and I want you to do it, Jules. And I was a little distressed because it's hard to get into the JAG Corps. And right. The Inspector General Corps is a completely different corps and has a different function. So the Inspector General, their task is to go out and visit units to make sure those units are following the regulations.
To sniff out problems.
Yes. And when you find some organization that's not performing correctly, then you have to instruct them and get them to have an opportunity to get on the right path and largely convince that lower level leader, this is the standard, you're not meeting the standard, step up, right? And you only go tell the boss if they don't step up. That really was a very helpful experience for me because, you know, we don't write the rules, right? The rules are what the rules are, and we just try and get people to comply with the rules.
Wait, that's a story in our house. The rules are the rules, or the woos are the woos, is what we say. Yeah. But sometimes people don't really want to know what the rules are.
Yes.
And when they're reminded,
right?
Is it tough?
Well, I want to kind of show the parallel. You know, a trial court judge is not a policymaker.
Right.
The trial
court judge
don't decide what the rules are. Mm-hmm. Trial court judge just listen to the evidence
and enforce
and apply the law to the facts and then produce the result, a report of what the result is.
So your experience led you to run for a judge.
A number of experiences. So, in addition to that military experience, there was a time when I served as a counsel to legislators. I worked for the Louisiana Senate, right? And so I would help senators draft bills, right? And help them conduct committee hearings. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that was an opportunity for me to research on a wide variety of subjects in order to help give the information to the policymakers so that they could be well-informed to make the best policy.
And that's important because drafting laws, you can mess up policy so easily. So you were in Baton Rouge during
Baton Rouge. That job allowed me to practice law on the side.
Okay.
So I had the private practice and
drive
over there, right? And so it was really comfortable because the Louisiana Senate or legislature, they have periods where they're intensely busy. Mm-hmm. Preparing for the session, during the session, shortly after the session.
And then it's dead.
Long periods of nothing.
I did that too. I was a senator.
Right. And so there is also a state statute that says whenever the Senate's in session, the senators and lawyers who work for the Senate can get a guaranteed continuance. Mm-hmm. So anytime that they were in session, I'd get my matters continued. And when the session was over, I could be able to attend those matters. But I'm saying that to say that I have served in all three branches of state government. The National Guard is the executive branch.
Yeah.
The Senate is the legislative branch.
And now judicial.
Judge. Yes.
So what got you to run? I mean, you ran for judge as a young person. 93.
Yes.
You were young.
Yes, that is very true. So,
like, you've been in there
27 years, I believe it is. Yes. So, it was during the session, this, and I don't remember when it was, it must have been in, I guess, 92, there was a great effort to, as a result of some lawsuits that had been successful, there was an effort to create minority sub-districts throughout the state. So there would be an opportunity for the voters, black voters, to elect the candidate of their choice. Mm-hmm. The way the system, the cases determined, Chisholm and can't remember the other case, but Sylvia
Cooks
was one of the plaintiffs in the case, and the decision indicated that the way the system was organized, it diluted the black voters' voting strength,
that.
And they were not able to elect the candidates of their choice.
Had you thought about that before, had you really given it thought?
I really had not thought about it at all.
You were busy, but I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Well, I'm saying after it passed, I was busy trying to recruit candidates.
Various lawyers in town are saying
now that it's the law, these opportunities are available, you know, because there were two seats on our court and one seat in the Third Circuit. And so I was recruiting lawyers in Lafayette, you know, trying to talk to them, why don't you run? And one day I was at the Senate and I was speaking to my state senator.
Who was that?
Don Cravens.
Yeah.
Right, and I was lamenting. I said, "I'm not able to get anywhere. I'm not even convince anybody
what
to move to
say?
Run." He stood me up. He walked me to the corner wall, and there was a mirror in the wall. And he had me look in the mirror. He said, "What's wrong with that guy?"
Oh God!
And I said, "Oh,
no." This is a big risk. Huh?
Yeah. So after that, I said, "Well, I have to go talk to the boss. I had to go talk to the wife." And so I came home, and the next day,
was she okay?
I was decided. Oh yeah, I was.
And where did you live? Like, what district was it? Did it matter where you lived in Lafayette?
Really, no.
Was it like just a minority seat?
So the way I lived on Mud Avenue, mm-hmm. right, one block off of the thruway. All right, but the way the law is, the candidate can live anywhere in the 15th Judicial District. The sub-districts just decide which voters can vote for which mm-hmm. seats, right? So the residency requirement, you don't have to live in the sub-district where the voters live, right? It just so happened I did. Mm-hmm. I did.
But it wasn't
a legal requirement.
Right. Now, judges, I want to ask you... I've run for office twice before, and I know as like a candidate for city council or state rep, mm-hmm. you really have to walk, and you can call people to raise money, but running for judge is different, right? You can't really be raising money yourself. Maybe you could then, but there's a lot of strings attached to running. It's very difficult to run for judge,
I find. Yes, you have to have a campaign committee,
and they do
and the committee
dirty
can
work.
Raise the money.
Because
right?
raising money is tough.
Right, so a judicial candidate cannot ask anybody for money. You can ask for support, but you can't ask for money.
And it was like that when you ran?
Yes. And so...
That's kind of nice.
But that's not the principal... That's not the principal difference, at least in my opinion. You see... A judge can only make one kind of promise. A person running for an executive position, governor, mayor, a person running for a legislative position, city council, state representative, mm-hmm. senate, those kinds of people, they can promise a variation of one of the three things. A promise to do something for you. A promise to do something to you. A promise not to do something to you. Right? A judge can only promise to be fair.
Right.
That's all a judge can only promise to
and
be
what,
fair.
And what is fair? Like, what is being fair as a judge?
Okay. So, I think fair is a word that refers to, I think, a better word, which is justice. And justice is giving that which is due mm-hmm. to the other. Okay, and so under our system of law, we want the judges to look to see, well, what are the rules? The rules are made by the policymakers. That's the legislature. Once we discern what the rules are, then we have to determine if it's a judge case, the judge determines what the facts are. If it's a jury case, the jury determines what the facts are, and then the judge applies the law to the facts.
Yeah.
And so it's not what I want the result to be, it is what has been proven. And so that's why it's very important to have good lawyers, and very important to have good witnesses.
Right.
Because I tell people all the time that the law and a trial, that's not an act of history. It's not an act of anthropology. In a trial, you're trying to determine what facts can be proven, what facts have been proven, right? That's not the same thing as what actually is. Right. And it's not a scientific discovery. And science continues forever, right? There's never a final answer. There's always performing more, a different experiment, right? But a trial, we need to come to an answer fairly quickly. And so we get the best answer of what the truth is based on what was evidence that was presented in that trial on those days, so we know the answer, right?
You know, Judge, I think we all want equal treatment under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can fast forward a bit, I know that you served on the a commission that looked at sentencing guidelines, because we don't all get equal treatment.
Yes.
And let's be honest, if you don't have a judge that's fair, if you don't have lawyers that are competent or lawyers that are really engaged in your case, you don't get equal treatment.
Right.
And so you've really committed yourself, if you can talk about that. And I think that's been in the news more, you know, even the guy that was on the singing show, America's Top Idol. There's a fellow that, I don't know if I have the show right, but he served, you know, decades of time because he wasn't given a fair trial.
Yes.
And only with DNA evidence was he released.
Yes.
But you've really stepped up, and you're a minority. You're an African-American. You've probably seen this in your community, but you've lived it as a judge too, wanting to see justice prevail.
Yes.
Can you talk about your heart and what you've done?
So I think that there's a concept called procedural justice that's very important, and because judges really issue opinions, right? And so people will follow a judge's judgment if they believe it was arrived at fairly, okay? And so the litigants, they desperately want to be heard. People come to court and some of the most
and that's
trying,
a last resort. Like, nobody wants
time.
To be in court.
Yes. So people come to court, they're anxious, they're afraid, they're upset. It's a highly emotional event. And so they want to know that the judge takes their case seriously, that it's important, the judge is paying attention, the judge is actively involved in the case. And as a result of that, if they believe that, then they are more likely to follow through with the judgment that's made.
Whether it's civil or criminal people accepting the verdict.
I was heard, and the result, even if it didn't go in my favor, right?
I got my day in court.
Yes. Yeah. And therefore, it's the whole process is perceived to be legitimate. And if it's perceived to be legitimate, people cooperate. You know, because if people don't think it's legitimate, then they can resist the order and to kick in their heels, and that makes the whole process much more expensive. And so it's very important that a judge is involved. And you mentioned my work with the Sentencing Commission.
Yeah, tell us about Louisiana, so, where we've been. That was a few years back.
Louisiana Sentencing Commission, that work was started in an effort to try and provide more consistency across the state. Because there's disparate treatment depending on where the case was tried. You know, one judge may say the result is X, another judge say the result is Y, and so we're trying to get judges to be aware of evidence-based practices.
Regional throughout the state.
Throughout the whole state.
And not just locally, but
right, no,
regional.
Throughout the whole state. Oh. Get judges to be aware of evidence-based practices and procedures and employ them. And so similarly, my work with the Louisiana Judicial College. Mm-hmm. So the Louisiana Judicial College is the organization that trains judges, provides judicial education to judges.
You didn't know what to do when you showed up?
And so
it's a tough job.
In that role, I was creating classes that we would provide to the judges so that judges would be more informed when they exercise their discretion. To think of a number of different things, how people perceive what's occurring and how to treat people, how to respond to people. Because again, like I said, it's a highly charged environment, and we want judges to be professional. We want judges to be patient. We want judges to be attentive and be ever respectful.
Right. Now, you've also really dedicated time to drug court, to young people. And before we get into your race, I mean, you're on the Advisory Council on Heroin and Opioid Prevention and Education, and also the Louisiana Drug Policy Board. You must see in state district court a lot of criminal cases that don't need to be. Am I right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So for several years now, I've been fortunate enough. In Lafayette, I handle all of the criminal cases I preside over on the 15th Judicial District for several years now have been in Lafayette. And for most of that time, they've been only drug cases. So drug cases, so if you, right now, and for several years now, if a person was arrested for a drug case in Lafayette Parish, they're coming to me, right?
No matter what?
Simple possession, distribution, whatever. If it's a drug case, it's going to come into my track.
So you get to know the community that's repeat offenders.
Oh, yes. And whether the person pleads guilty or is convicted, we have a process of identifying what was the best way to approach this person. So we want to make sure that if it's a person who is newly experimenting, right, we don't put them in the same groups with the people who are, you know, distributors.
Drug lords,
right. And so we have a little screening process that helps me determine what kind of conditions of probation they should receive, if they should receive probation. And I conduct I tell the probation officers that as soon as you detect a small problem, let's file a motion and get them in court so we can get them back on the right track. The goal is not to revoke the probation. The goal is to make sure that we nudge them from the road to perdition back to the road to success.
Are you seeing young people mainly? Like, what is the average? Is there an average?
Wow. No, you'd be amazed.
Is it white, black?
Like, oh, it's everybody.
Do you see women?
Yes. It's men. It's
trying to
women.
Make money.
17-year-olds, 65-year-olds.
Do you see people like me? Women that
Yes. Your age. Age. Not usually your class. Right.
But you're seeing people that need to make a buck.
It's poor people. It's undereducated people. I will say this. One of the principal difficulties in our society is we do not do a good job of adequately socializing our children. Okay. And so they don't have this. It hasn't been a focused effort to develop their character, right? It's not something that's intentionally done.
Right.
And so therefore, more often than not, the character is not developed. Many people have a tendency to make a decision about whether something is right or wrong based on whether it will give me pain or pleasure right now.
In the moment.
Right now.
Yeah.
If it will give me pain right now, pleasure right now, but pain a week from now, it's still a good thing.
Right.
If it'll give me pleasure right now, it's a good thing. Whether it gives me pain later, right. They rarely think about how my behavior impacts other people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Or consequences of their own life.
Right. And so
this must be heartbreaking as a judge.
Yes, but the good news is that there are evidence-based practices and procedures that can help people get back on the right track. Mm-hmm. It's really not rocket science, and anyone who has been the parent of a tween, a teen, mm-hmm. they know how to do this.
Well, you know, everybody makes mistakes, but when you're young, really not thinking about tomorrow.
Yes. And people, this is it's kind of a trite saying, but there are many people that I don't care how much you know until I know how much you care. And so you have to be very careful to not judge a person's value by the stupidest decision they've made. You know, a person can have a bad day and do something really bad, but that doesn't mean that that forever and ever they are that person. People can grow. People can change.
You've seen that?
Oh, yes. People change. People change.
Now,
yes.
Before we started taping, you were working, right?
Yes.
Where did you just come from?
Yes, I came from the courthouse.
Yeah? Well, tell me what was going on.
So we had a drug court docket today.
An adult drug court docket,
and
who was like, what kind of people were in front of you?
Oh, men, women, young, old.
Does it go fast? Like, what do you do?
So the principal focus is to have frequent and regular contact between the judge and the participant. You see, many of these people have never had an authority figure take real interest in their lives.
You're talking about a parent, anybody?
Parent, teachers, anybody, right? Many people who have been educationally wounded by our schools. I can tell you, when I first started this, the condition of probation that caused the most resistance is when I tell people you have to get your GED.
Oh.
Right?
They're not comfortable with that.
They don't mind going to do community service. They don't mind doing 2 days, a week in jail. But you want me to go back in the classroom? Oh, I have horrible memories from being in the classroom. Right? But I digress. So we want to have the people come to court regularly so that we can capture their performance over the past week. Mm-hmm. So this past week, you did this particular thing, it was a good thing. We did that particular thing, it was a bad thing. You did this thing, it was a good thing. And we want to give positive reinforcement.
It's like the dinner table in the Beaver Cleaver days, right? Talking about what you did, what was the best thing that happened to you.
Yes.
But they don't get that.
Want to give you positive reinforcement for the smallest good thing.
That's the only time that you think they'll get, most of them will get that?
And as a result of that, they have an incredible desire to please the judge.
And that's
they want to come to court having done well and get their good behavior acknowledged.
Worthy.
Yes.
They're worthy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So they
so you know them. You know a lot of the people that you see.
You'd be amazed when I go to Walmart or Costco or the grocery store, I regularly have people saying, Judge Edwards, Judge, how you doing? It's been 10 years. And you say, you know, you sent me to prison. And I say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, right? And
they're thriving.
Yes, yes. So, typically, when I send someone to be incarcerated, it's so that they can participate in some rehabilitative program that I offered them while they were free, but they refused to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? So, slow down, get you locked up. In here, you have to consume it, right? And then you come back out. So, sending people to prisons for long periods of time is really expensive, and it really doesn't do much. They learn bad things in prison.
And they don't get educated there, right?
Well,
in Louisiana, are they able to get an education?
You can get your GED, yes. And you can. They will provide you with vocational education. You can earn a trade. But the vast majority of the time, you're just sitting around. Okay? And so I found it to be more effective to send folks for a short period of time, and during that short period of time, they can achieve their education. They can get some moral formation, right? They can get some vocational skills, and they know that's what they're there for. And so if they get it, and I've told them, if you get it earlier than the amount of time it takes, I'll bring you out early.
Oh, gosh. Right?
So their behavior, they're better behaved prisoners because they're on a mission. I need to get out of here.
Right?
But if you send them to jail for prison for decades, then the vast majority of that time, they're just going to be sitting around and talking to the guys and gals that are there and learning bad stuff.
But Jules, I'm going to ask, you know, you've served as president of the Louisiana District Judges Association. You've been in office for 27 years. Now, you're a candidate for a judicial seat for the city court.
Yes.
And I want to ask you to talk about why I'm calling it a sideways move.
Yes.
You're moving, you know, by choice from being in a safe seat, I think, with the 15th Judicial District.
Yes.
But the city court, and I looked up their jurisdiction, and I know that you have a passion for helping young people that get into criminal problems, but the jurisdiction is alleged violations of any state misdemeanor criminal laws or any consolidated government ordinance violations that occur within the city of Lafayette. And you also have jurisdiction at the city court over juvenile traffic, criminal offenses, and you provide juvenile service help for families in need of service and children in need of care. So if we can segue, why would you want to leave a safe position you're still young, you know, to go to city court, which is a very honorable position to be, but it's a different level of care. So can you talk about who you'd be seeing in district, you know, like from district court going to the city court? It's a different group of people.
Yes. And I recognize that it's a very unusual move. You know, district court judges typically go for an appellate seat, right? They go up. But very rarely, as you mentioned, do they go sideways.
Sideways,
And so I can tell you that the work that I do now is very rewarding. I'm very pleased, very honored, I feel very privileged to have this opportunity to serve in this way. And it's also distressing. Okay, that when people come to court, they're usually on the civil side, they're arguing about money. Okay, and a lot of times those arguments have gone off track because they've gotten kind of emotionally involved. These are smart people. People in business disputes,
they spend a lot of money on lawyers.
Yes, yes,
you're vested once you spend $100,000 on litigation.
Yes. So that can be distressing. Mm-hmm. And then of course the folks that are coming for criminal cases, some cases have victims, even the cases without victims, there's lots of distress and harm that has occurred, right? And by the time I see the folks who have been involved in criminal cases, they've gotten themselves in big trouble, and they've caused massive harm to other people. And far too many times, this is not their first rodeo.
So these are felons that have a record a lot of times.
They are serving a life sentence on the installment plan and don't know it, right? So they're convicted now, they get a sentence, and they go and serve that sentence. A couple years later, they're back again. And there's two good things about my job. Adoptions and drug court, okay? And I think that drug courts have proven their worth in our state. People know the value of drug courts.
And what happens in drug court, though, like quickly? Like what? What happens when somebody goes to drug court?
So
are they early offenders?
So it could be first-time offenders, but usually it's not. Usually it's a person who is a second or a third offender, right?
But they've done, like, petty sales or something?
Well, yeah.
So or just caught with
it could be possession,
weed on their body?
It could be possession. It could be distribution. It could be a property crime where drugs were involved, so a burglary.
Oh, and right? They just happen to have...
They were breaking into somebody's house to get the money to use drugs. So it's somebody with a drug habit, and they're committing petty crimes or property crimes to get money to use for their drug habit, right? Mm-hmm. And so those people will come in, and so you get into drug court, and it's designed to be completed in 18 months, and it starts off real intense. So initially you come and see the judge once a week, and you see your substance abuse counselors three times a week. And then as you move up the phases, the frequency and intensity decreases. Oh. So by the time you're in phase three, you're seeing the judge maybe once every month, and you're seeing the counselors maybe once a week.
And you're employed and showing that you could be a productive
member
of society.
And then after 18 months is done, and then you can commence, graduate, and then you have to be on probation for another year, and so that we can see that you don't get in any trouble. And then at that point, we terminate your probation early, and you can get the conviction set aside.
So that's one of the best things about what you do as a district court judge.
Right. So you get your record cleared up, right? So you come in and you're convicted, and then the conviction is set aside and is treated as if you were found not guilty. That's one. And for the true first offender, that person can come in, can plead guilty, but the guilty plea is not accepted. I mean, I don't adjudicate them guilty. Right, and so they can truly say they were never convicted or never became a convicted felon.
They do the compliance with the court's requirements. Mm-hmm. So, in district court, you've seen like higher level cases.
Yes.
But I know your heart's pulling you to work with people before they get into deep trouble.
That's exactly the point. I want to work with people who have just started on that road to perdition. They've gone down and they're starting to cause a few problems for themselves and others, but they don't have this wreckage of bodies and property damage that would have accumulated over many, many, many years.
So they're more juveniles, like younger people, or not necessarily?
It could be people who are having a juvenile case, you know, or it could be people in adult court who are, you know, 20, under 30, right? You know, the brain isn't fully developed until you're, you know, 25 or so,
right?
And so people are not making good, not thinking well, not making good decisions. And it's easy to get sucked into this life of crime by the folks you hang out with, right? Mm-hmm. And so people change when they know what to change, why to change, and how to change. Mm-hmm. And so I have a proven record of helping people get to see that. Right? And they want that. They learn to want to change. And then they learn how to change. And then they change.
So have you had dinner conversation, you know, at home with your wife and your children about, I'm a district court judge and I want to shift gears? Like, what happened?
They thought I was nuts.
I bet. But, you know, like, whatever.
Yes.
We're all nuts. Yes. But, I mean, you're kind of taking a big risk. Because you've got a safe seat, and you're very well respected. I just have to say that.
Well, thank you.
But your heart is in service.
I mean,
we all know that.
My family
and others know that.
Yes.
You know.
So I think that I have always my entire. Remember, I said I never knew what I wanted to do when I grew up.
I didn't either.
I've come to act
before you know what works.
I've come to the conclusion. I've always been preparing to become this city judge. I just didn't know it. I just didn't know it.
So we have a judge that's retiring.
Yes.
Francie Bouillon.
That's Francie Bouillon's retiring. That'll be a vacant seat.
Yeah.
And
the election's this November. And you've got a cohort there, Doug Saloom.
Doug Saloom is...
Like his dad.
Yes.
Like a pillar, you know, Collie Saloom.
Yes.
And Doug is very serious about...
Yes.
He's tough on crime.
And
Doug
is tough.
Very fair,
and
though.
Organized and
organized. Yeah.
And knows how to run the court. And I have a lot of respect for Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be honored to have an opportunity to serve with him again. You know, he was in the public defender's office before he was elected, and
you knew him.
He practiced in my court. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So, how old are you now?
I am 66.
Okay, so you're very young.
Mm.
So to do this, like, what's the best thing you can say about serving as a judge in our community, at no matter what level,
yes.
Jules, you know, whether it's the court or the city court, what would you like to see for our community? What would you like people to know? And, you know, I just interviewed Reggie Thomas. We were talking about, I guess, how people are policed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing people that have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the consequences of things going on, maybe that could be changed.
Yes.
You know, do you have any thoughts about what you'd like to see in our community and how we can make a difference for
well,
judicial fairness?
I absolutely. I think that people want, as I mentioned, to be heard, right? And people want justice to be fair. So the people in our community don't want there to be one set of rules on one part of town and another set of rules on a different part of town. Again, the rules are the rules, and people should be able to expect fairness and consistency. And I think that folks, I want to be the person who provides that. I want to be the person that people know when they come to court, I'll give them a fair shake. And I'm very interested in learning what happened. I don't have any preconceived notions. We are having a trial so that we can determine what has been proven. And that's my goal.
Right. I know you've got I wanted to pull this up. You've pledged to all, really, as a district court judge, to be firm yet fair. And your message to everyone is dare to dream.
Yes.
So even if people find themselves in court, they have a future.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's the point. Mm-hmm. Again, whatever happened in the past, it happened, okay? So there needs to be some accountability. You need to recognize that what you did was wrong and it had a negative impact on others, and you need to find a way to correct that, to make it right as best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to know that the community will embrace you once they see you doing
right.
that. Yes.
Now, we've been kind of light on your judicial race. I don't even have your website. Where can people find out more about Judge Jules Edwards while we're talking? If they want to know more about your background, about your candidacy, or just even know how to contact anyone, I can add that to our show notes.
Yes.
If you don't have that right in front of you.
It's edwardsforcityjudge.com.
Yep. All right.
edwardsforcityjudge.com. And once you get there, you'll see that we also have a Facebook page.
Okay.
And we'll be providing lots of information. edwardsforcityjudge.com.
Well, Judge Jules Edwards, I'm humbled as a fellow lawyer to be sitting here with you. My resume is so weak compared to yours, and I'm very humbled to have you here in my home. We're still taping at my home during the COVID, you know, distancing. We've followed the distancing rules, but I want to thank you for all you've done. I know you've been very kind with the Bar Foundation, the Bar Association, both locally and statewide, and I want to commend you for your service. And I want other young people to know that following a judicial path, following, you know, getting a degree in law is a very humbled and a honorable possession.
Yes.
Profession.
Yes.
So thank you for what you've done. And
thank you for inviting me. Thank you for sharing this time with me. And we appreciate your service. Well, all the service letting people know that the North Lafayette is a great place.
You know, all of Lafayette's a great place, but especially North Lafayette and Upper Lafayette. So thank you for getting that in.
Yes.
And while we're doing that, I want to thank our sponsors. We are very grateful for Iberia Bank. We've got Lafayette General Health. And really marketing that helps us. And just as important is Raider and Jason Sikora that will take our tape that I send and mix it and judge, let your voice be heard and other voices.
Yes.
So for anybody that would like to know more about Discover Lafayette, please visit discoverlafayette.net. And just as importantly, if you can pull out your phone, get your podcast app, it's a little purple icon, and you can subscribe to this and have this show and every show delivered on Friday mornings. It really helps us share the good news about our community.
Yes.
On behalf of Discover Lafayette.
And I thank Jason.
Thank Jason, yes. I know. Thank you, Judge. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.